Near where I grew up in Toronto, there's a massive cemetery that we used to go for walks through. And it was full of small undulating hills and massive maple and pine trees. And the grass was green in the summer and there were deer year-round. And when you'd walk through and the deer would see you, they'd leap over some of the tombstones and run off. There's something pretty marvelous about that image, about that idea of growth in a cemetery. It may sound trite. I know it kind of sounds trite, but that doesn't make it untrue. I love when I've gone to England and gone to overgrown graveyards there, to the really, really old ones, the ones that are, you know, the newest tomb there is probably older than Winnipeg. And there's just roots everywhere and moss covering everything, and shrubs and old trees. And I love cemeteries in rural Manitoba as well. I imagine the Cardale Cemetery is the one that always comes to mind for me. But it's a prototypical rural cemetery. You've got fields upon fields, and there in the midst of these fields is a small copse of trees surrounding pristine grass and tombstones. It's no wonder that once upon a time, graveyards were common places for families to go for picnics on Sunday afternoons, that people would go for visits and spend time in them regularly. But we don't really do that anymore. When cemeteries are vibrant and green, they are places where life and death are held together so tenderly, and it adds to that hallowed sense of sacred ground. Suffice it to say, there's a reason that John describes the tomb of Jesus as being in a garden. There's a reason that after Joseph of Arimathea took Jesus' body down from the cross, after Nicodemus brought spices to anoint the body, after the two wrapped the body in linen, they laid it in a tomb, and that tomb was in a garden. This is the gospel that starts with, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being." This gospel begins with creation, and it culminates with a garden. This is a strong allusion that the author is making to the Garden of Eden. This gospel begins with creation, and it ends with new creation. All that stuff that we've been talking about since we started in the Gospel of John, since we started with the wedding of Cana, we started talking about the beginning or the impending age of wine throughout Lent as you are doing the water, age of water into the age of wine. Here we have it. For John, this is it. That movement happens in the death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. The age of water has become the age of wine. The old creation is made new. And this is it. And I look around and I think, really? Is this the new age? Is this the promised age of wine? Because there's something incredibly disappointing about that idea to me. I don't know about anyone else, but to me, if this is the age of wine, if this is it, what John is celebrating, I don't know. Something about that shoe doesn't fit. It makes it all kind of hard to accept, doesn't it? The idea that Jesus was raised is tough enough to accept. To imagine this as some sort of subsequent utopia certainly doesn't help. One thing that I appreciate about the Gospel of John is the writer's willingness to allow room for people to get or not get what's going on. There's comfort in that. John provides a lot of room for that. First, we get the beloved disciple, who tradition has aligned with John. That's why we call it the Gospel of John, though he's never actually named. He doesn't entirely get it, but he understands that something good is happening. He's quicker off the hop than anybody else, and that's the beloved disciple for you throughout this gospel. This gospel goes to great lengths to show how marvelous the beloved disciple is. And it gets a bit tiresome, I'm going to be honest with you. It gets a bit tiresome. It never misses an opportunity to show how much better than Peter he is. He even runs faster than Peter. They're very clear. John is faster than Peter. He sees the burial cloth nicely folded, and he believes. That's what it says. He believes. What that means isn't entirely clear. But John, the beloved disciple, he gets it. Peter, on the other hand, surprise, surprise, in John's gospel, doesn't seem to get it at all. He goes into the tomb, he sees the linen, and nothing. He doesn't know what's happening at all. And yet that's okay. And then there's Mary, who's sort of in between. Mary, it takes a bit of time for her. She thinks at first the body has been removed, but then she has an experience of the risen Christ, and she starts to get it. And all of these are okay. The gospel provides space for people to come to understand and grasp the resurrection, to grasp the new age in their own time, in their own way. We can't all be the beloved disciple. And here's what I think they've figured out. Here's what it means to me. There's a pattern to the universe. And I've mentioned this before, but there's a pattern to the universe, and I think this pattern is at the heart of the Easter story. It's a pattern of life and death and resurrection, and it's woven into everything. I've said before, we see it in supernovas at the end of a star's life, but they die, but in the moment of their death, they create more complex atoms in the process. That's where carbon, that's where oxygen, that's where iron comes from. Anything that's not hydrogen, helium, and maybe a bit of lithium, it comes from the death of stars. We see it in evolution as creation pushes and pulls on itself, creating more life, creating more diversity. This is the pattern, life, death, and resurrection, life, death, and new life that was, quote, in the beginning with God, that all things came into being through and without which not one thing came into being. And in Jesus, we see this divine pattern of the universe, life, death, resurrection, embodied in humanity. And when we begin to see this, when we begin to let this idea permeate our lives, when we begin to no longer see death, either the little deaths that all of us are invited to walk through throughout our lives, or the great death at the end, when we begin to see the possibility of something beyond that, that somehow those deaths, that our deaths, again with a lowercase d or a big capital D, can be made holy. We begin to see that raising up, that being made new, is a part of the universe's process. And not just for out there, but for humanity. When we can hold life and death together in our hands and our hearts, knowing that each gives birth to the other. When we begin to see this, then we enter into a new world. We enter into a new age. To quote Richard Rohr, if all of our crucifixions are leading to some possible resurrection and not dead-end tragedies, this changes everything. Everything. This is why I like that language of the age of wine, because the age of wine implies a life becoming permeated by a sort of, and I'll quote Jerry South, he used this language on Good Friday and I liked it, effervescence. In the age of wine, in the life of wine, we are filled with a sort of effervescence. An effervescence fueled by the awareness that the great act of creation is ongoing, that it's never done. That the great act of creation is ongoing in the universe, and the great act of creation is ongoing in you. In humanity, it is never done. You are not a finished product. Even into and through and beyond death, whether it's those smaller deaths that we all face, the end of relationships or grief or suffering or whatever crucifixions we all go through in our lives, whether it's those smaller deaths or whether it's the great death that we all face, somehow that which you are, somehow your life will continue to permeate through existence, continue to have meaning, continue to participate in the great act of creation. It may be changed. It may be different. It may be incomprehensible to you. Remember, Mary didn't recognize Jesus. She saw the risen Christ, and she didn't know who it was. Because he was different. Death will change us. It will transform us. It may even make us unrecognizable to ourselves, perhaps even incomprehensible to ourselves. But when we realize this process is in our lives, when we begin to trust it, when we begin to see the process of the universe, the process of creation is not simply life and death, but rather life, death, and resurrection, suddenly life tastes different. I'll use that word again. Suddenly life has an effervescence to it. It delights. It is celebratory. We are no longer bound by the constriction of death. We are free to move through death into something new. The age of wine has been in existence since the dawn of creation. Jesus simply embodies it. He proclaims it through his life and death and resurrection. Jesus is the invitation for us to encounter it and know it. Jesus is the yeast that allows human life to ferment into something more. The age of wine is both eternal and new. When the bubbles from the age of wine, from the age of new life, percolate through us, when the effervescence of resurrection permeates our hearts and our minds, when the yeast that is Jesus transforms our lives from water to wine, then we too become like the must at the bottom of a wine barrel. Any other winemakers here? A few. That must, which contains more yeast, which can be used to make new wine again and again. We become like that must, transforming those around us, so that this age of wine, which both begins in our own hearts, while all the while having been woven into the very fabric of creation, through life, death, and resurrection, suddenly transforms the lives of those around us. And it begins to spread that joy and that effervescence to all who know it. The age of wine is upon us. Thanks be to God. Amen.